Thank you, Matt. My name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Pete.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for inviting me, Billy H. It's an honor and a privilege to be here in this group. It's great to be back. I've had a chance on Zoom to come back since this pandemic, but I remember being there in person in 2008. It's a beautiful thing when I lived in Charlottesville. And I'd like to welcome anybody that's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, anybody that's not new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and wow, my sobriety date is November 16th, 1991, and I am thoroughly grateful for that. I am very full right now, not only full from the dinner I had, but full from an incredible weekend of Alcoholics Anonymous and Pockets of Enthusiasm that was just an inspiring, loving event, full of speakers that that blew me away, you know, with a message that was just a solid message of Alcoholics Anonymous, an inspiring message, almost like a pep talk. So much so that when I was working with the sponsee today, I just kept thinking of what Larry Thomas said or what Don Major was saying. They were like, in my head, boom. You know, it's like they came right out. And it's just an incredible event. Great to be a part of and to be of service. There was something that, and I'm not going to quote these guys, I promise, because, I mean, that's the last thing you guys want. But when I heard Ralph speak this morning, and he said it a couple of days ago, and he talked about a sense of renewal that he has had with Zoom. And I'm not just going to say that, oh yeah, I agree with him, and because I absolutely 100% from my heart do, but it's my direct experience in the sense that I have experienced a renewal in these last 6 or 7 months. And I know people have gone through hardship and then, like he was saying, and lost jobs, and my family has been ravaged with it, with, you know, with the COVID and some other stuff that's going on right now. And I'll get to it in a little bit. But he talked about it being a renewal of working the steps and just really prioritizing. He was like charged. And that's exactly what's happening to me. I think what had been going on for maybe a little while or a longer while was I was getting into that spot of grayness. I guess we call it the opposite of enthusiasm, you know, that spirit that is enthusiasm. It would be the opposite. I was there kind of living maybe off of past experiences of working through the steps, past experiences of going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous, past experiences, I guess, laurels, resting on your laurels. I was doing that. And I didn't know that until I started going through the steps again. I started going through the book again. I reconnected with Al Jay, who's like a second sponsor and an incredible mentor and somebody who has introduced me, got me right back plugged in. And I tell you, for me right now, what's been going on is that I've been going to sometimes 12 to 14 meetings a week on Zoom. That is unbelievable for somebody like me who a lot of times doesn't want to be inconvenienced, you know, self-centered. And it has been unbelievable what has happened. You know, reconnecting with my old home group in Bozeman, Montana. There's a guy here on the call from Bozeman who I've known for almost 25 years. Reconnecting with the Common Solution and the Buckingham Group and getting right back into the Pockets of Enthusiasm. Reconnecting with guys like Don and Bob and just being a part of being, you know, launched into Alaska with an old sponsee, and that becomes two committed meetings that are very late at night for me in the week here in Chicago, but are meetings that I don't want to miss. I've got that feeling that I don't want to miss this. And I feel blessed because I think, and I've seen this, I've seen it happen with people who have time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe their primary purpose becomes something else other than helping the alcoholic, or it becomes, you know, again, resting on laurels, or, you know, thinking that they can go to deal with less when in reality, I'm a guy that needs more. I love to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a beautiful feeling because what I'm realizing now, and it's like having gone through these steps again, I'll get back to it. I'm going to circle back. It's a chance. I'm realizing now what that reality is deep down within. And that when I'm in the middle, when I'm working with others, when I'm asking for help, when I'm trying to be of service, there is that God feeling, that God consciousness that it talks about in We Agnostics that is deep down within. And that is, and those intuitive thoughts and situations that, you know, baffle me. Now there seems to be answers. There seems to be hope. And so when Ralph was talking about that, I was like, yeah. And it's not just about the number of meetings. It's about the perception changing. Because alcoholism, as I have experienced it from the minute I was a kid until now, is a disease of perception. I've got a perception that's all about me. I'm so full of self-centered fear. I want to run. I run from everything. And my God, when I did this last fourth and fifth step, I hadn't done one since I had done one with Al. And that's a long time to go without doing that kind of work. And where I'm really writing down resentments and I'm really writing down fears and I'm really writing, you know, looking at sex conduct and seeing defects of character that were crippling me and harming others and relations with others. I was wondering why my relations with my parents were getting worse. And I was 28, 27 years of sobriety. And I was like thinking like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? And I wasn't telling anybody about it. I was just acting out. I was running. I was doing things that I do, what people like me do when I'm running on self, when I'm running on that with self-determined objectives, when I'm running on my head, I cause damage. And, you know, one of the things that's happening in my life right now is that my family's losing a very loved family member. It's my uncle. He's my godfather. He's my mom's twin brother. And it's been happened right before the start of this conference. And thank God for that Pockets of Conference to be able to be a part of, and but also to be able to show up and answer phone calls and to be there. I tell you what, had I not started to go through the steps, had I not been renewed, I'm not so sure what my actions would have been. I might have said, this is too inconvenient. That's probably what I say, because that's what somebody like me does. If it's too inconvenient, I ain't going to do it. But it hasn't been. Like right after Don talked, somebody called. I took the call and I just felt like there was Don with me, just coaching me, saying, this is how you handle this call with some love and comfort. A couple of days ago, I cried in front of my father for the first time in 20 years. And that's not something somebody like me does. And I just called and I just had those feelings. It wasn't because I was saying, oh, Daddy, please love me. I want your attention. It was just because it was a sense of intimacy and love that I actually felt. He was losing a brother-in-law that's like a brother to him. And I just emoted. And he was like, I hadn't cried since I graduated from college in 2000. Not in front of him, because, I mean, men don't cry. And I'm always stuffing that stuff down. And I'm realizing now that what's happening, and there'll be a trip to New Jersey this week after on Thursday to pay my respects and to be with family, and is that this is part of an amend. This is something I don't always talk about. And it's, I think the reason why is because I didn't do a good job of when my grandfather was about a year and a half sober, and I was living in Pennsylvania. I was at college, 21 years old, and I sobered up and I started to work the steps. I had made some attempts at sponsorship, and I managed to, my grandfather, who lived in New York City, was dying. He was dying of heart disease, heart failure, all that. And I hadn't seen him in over a year and a half. Now that was in sobriety. I'm going to get back to the drinking in a second. But when a series of causes and conditions got me from State College, Pennsylvania, where Penn State University is, an AA member managed, I wasn't driving because I had gotten a DUI and I was still dealing with the ramifications of all that, even that long after, and I was broke. He managed to get me to Brooklyn, New York, literally in time. I did the best attempt at a ninth step amends. I had a sponsor. We did the step work and I wrote it out and I read it to him. I did the best I could. And he was on his deathbed. My grandfather was on his deathbed. And he pulled me aside and he looked like a Holocaust survivor. I was bawling. And he pulled me aside and he held my arm and he said, "Pete, you have a family. What can I do to make it right?" And I heard him, or so I thought. I think part of the reason why I've barely shared that story or haven't is because I have not lived up to that. There have been that times of running from my family, and he died the next day. He died the next day. It was one of those amends that thank God I got a chance to be. But now, as my family's going through this again, and it's gone through it in the past, I feel him. I feel that I'm living up to what he has shared with me that I can do to make it right, to be of love and comfort with Alcoholics Anonymous as the backbone. I need you to help me do that, because on my own, I can't. I absolutely can't. I will run, and I am full of self-centered fear. That family, you know, I said I hadn't seen him in a year and a half. Well, that shows you where I was at, in not only in early sobriety, but back it up way before that. I grew up and I've come from a big Jewish family from Brooklyn, New York. And so, yeah, it's like a big Italian family. Everybody knows each other's business, and everybody, you know, my uncle's like a second father, and he would yell at me at times. So, I mean, we had that kind of relationship. And yet also I, you know, many ways like a hero, took risks and just a good guy. And so, but man, when I was at that time in early sobriety and before that, they were the problem. My family was the problem. Everything else was the problem. The religion was the problem. Judaism was the problem. My ex-girlfriend was the problem. Education was the problem. You name it, it was the problem. I had, even as I was still working, I was going through those steps in that early period. Right after I had come into Alcoholics Anonymous at age 19, I had not surrendered to my innermost self that I am a hopeless alcoholic, and that left to my own devices, my life actually gets worse in sobriety. And unless I did not have a strong sponsorship ethic. I did not, I guess you could say I wasn't really thinking of others at all. So without a strong sponsorship ethic, thinking of others is not to how I can be of use, wasn't at the forefront. It was barely even in my mindset at all in that very early period. It would become later. But backing this up, so I'm really grateful today. I'm grateful for a chance at second chances to make things right. Because from a very early age, I was running. I felt apart from. That anxious apartness, that sense of separation, that I didn't belong, that something was wrong. I didn't know how to be on a team. I didn't know how to be in a family. I didn't know how to be in a job. It was always about me. It was always about my thoughts. I always felt more at home when I was sitting in my room thinking about myself. Heard a speaker today talk about that. Just thinking, you know, just thinking. I mean, that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to act. You know, I didn't know how to be on a sports team, and I had some talent, but I was just so afraid of failure. I was so afraid that I wasn't good enough. Boy, I wish I could say I outgrew that fear. You want to know something? On this last inventory that I just did, 2 months ago, it was riddled with that I'm not good enough, that I'm going to be rejected. And that you're not going to like me if you really knew me for who I really, really, really am. And that kind of fear, that is the spiritual malady. That is that sense. Now, alcoholics aren't the only ones who have that. But man, oh man, I seem to have that. And boy, do I have it now, left to my own devices. I don't know how to be with you. I don't know how to be a team player. To be a member, a family member among family member, a worker among workers. With on my own power, on self-reliance, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. Not this self-reliance. Maybe some other people are able to get away with that. Maybe some other people who aren't alcoholic can. I can't. I hide. I'm so scared that self-centered fear. One of the things, and I think this became clear as, you know, later on in sobriety, but I had no idea that fear, self-centered fear, was the chief activator of all my defects of character. Every single one that could possibly, you could name, is at the core of it is self-centered fear. And so when it came time for me to show up and do family events, it was either, it was all going to be about me or I didn't want to go. When it came time to be a team player in school, it was either all going to be about me or I was going to start putting other people down or I would quit. I would run away from things. And I didn't know how to let people know what was really going on. I was scared that if I told you how I felt or if I had expressed invulnerability and intimacy, oh, I've seen a lot of that now. Oh. But at that time, it was hopeless. I experienced something when I was 10, 11 years old that does not make me an alcoholic. I experienced sexual abuse. I was in a camp in Pennsylvania in 1983, and it occurred, and it was not fun. I mean, it was a horrible experience. I mean, that goes without saying. I remember when my parents picked me up, and they were expecting to pick up a happy kid at a sleepaway camp in eastern Pennsylvania, and I just bawled my eyes out. And I just let it out. And I remember we started processing the case. And then after that, radio silence, crickets. I stuffed it down. You know, I felt ashamed. I felt embarrassed. I didn't want to let anybody know about this. And then, you know, and I certainly wasn't going to let, you know, I didn't want to talk to my parents about it. I know that they felt really horrible that something like this happened. I empathize with parents. And I'm not a parent today, but boy, I can just empathize. And there was one time that actually this occurred. I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but I just kind of feel that that's where my heart's going. I, you know, and about, my sister graduated from medical school and my dad was with me. We were in New Orleans and he brought up, there was a headline. I don't want to get in off in the subject. Just say one of the religious figures had gotten caught doing something. And basically my dad pointed it out to me and he said, Pete, how are you doing with what happened to you? And this was like 20 years later. And I jumped him, not physically. I got so angry. I reacted. I didn't realize that I had that. I went from 0 to 100 in about a nanosecond. And I made him feel less than. I belittled him and he never brought it up again. But I knew. Well, now I know because it came up big time in this last inventory. And it came up not as much on resentment. It came up on fear. Just absolute fear of being with somebody else, being intimate. And not just that kind of intimacy, but just letting somebody in. Letting somebody into my heart. Letting somebody in, and that it's okay, you know, to not be perfect. It's okay. And I didn't know all that was going on. And that I was putting up that wall. And I had looked at this, but it not enough. And so back then, I tell you what, I started stuffing that stuff around. I found that I was starting to look for the quickest ways to get attention, and that was to perform, to be who I thought you wanted me to be. You know, that chameleon type character, whatever it is. And I become a teenager, and I'm somebody that I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. I was that straight A nerd in junior high school and people were making fun of me and picking on me. And I thought, you know what? At least I was getting the grades, but I felt terrible because my mom was doing a lot of my homework and she was helping me succeed or, you know, she was doing the best she thought she was doing. She was doing the best she could. But what I knew that I just felt like this wasn't mine. And so trying to use that kind of solution to fill that hole, that malady, that feeling of apartness, the grades, that didn't work. And so I had my first drink when I went through the Jewish celebration called a bar mitzvah. And I had a rum and coke. And man, oh man, it was delicious. I loved what it did for me. Now, I didn't start to drink. I guess what you could, you know, that craving, that obsession didn't kick in for a little while. So I did not go get crazy right there in the middle of that ceremony, but I filed it and I knew exactly what I wanted when the time came. And so I have all that fear. I have all that sense of inadequacy. I have all that feeling like I don't belong. Even if I'm performing, I'm getting grades, I'm doing well. I'm trying to get all that stuff to take care of that God-sized hole that is in my heart. And by that time, what was starting to happen before I got into, you know, drinking heavily, I was angry at my family. It was starting to lash out. I was starting to, and so by the time I was about 15 or 16 years old, they couldn't trust me. They couldn't trust me at all for very good reason. So when they went away, when I was a teenager, they basically said, you got to go over to this guy's house. Now, I grew up in Fairfax, Virginia, not too far from where some of you guys live in right there. And so I'm in suburbia and I'm over at this buddy's house. And I had only really started to drink for real about a week prior. This is October, ironically, October about 1988. And I promise I'm not going to give you a drunkalog because nobody wants to hear one of those, but I want to make sure I share some stories that really talk about powerlessness and unmanageability and what that means to have a mental obsession and a physical phenomenon of craving and then the utter inability to leave it alone after that. And so within that very first week, I took a morning drink. I got caught. And I couldn't understand why somebody would be exasperated at me. I was over at another buddy's house and I loved that. And that time the phenomenon of craving kicked in and I took a morning drink and I got caught and he looked at me and I said, what's wrong? He goes, that's my dad's beer. And I said, well, I need this. So I needed it at that time right away. I mean, I don't know about being born an alcoholic or I don't know about all that stuff, but I can say this. I did not ramp up to this because the very next week, my parents are out of town. They send me to over somebody else's house because I'm untrustworthy, you know, starting to vandalize property at this time, starting to do all sorts of stuff like that. And they did not want me home alone for very good reason. I'm going to a homecoming dance with an ex-girlfriend at that time, blind date situation up at Lake Braddock High School, if anybody's familiar with that area. And so, what do I do before that dance? I take a drink. What do I do again? I take another drink, another one, and another one. That phenomenon of craving really hit hard. In fact, I remember throwing out the last Miller bottle, literally right before we showed up at this person's house to eat a steak dinner, And when I got in there, I was buzzing and meat was falling all over the place. And before you know it, they're all looking at me and I'm like happy and thinking now I'm putting on a show and I'm completely making a mockery of this poor girl's life. She was expecting a real date and she got me and she got a drunk me or somebody who was half drunk and needed more. She got that guy. And so that she left me in the middle of that dance and I'm like wondering why she didn't want to do anything more. I was looking for other things that I thought I was supposed to get from that whole experience. And before you know it, she's gone and I'm back with my buddy Tom and he gets me out of there and it couldn't have happened quick enough. And we end up back at his house and there's beer and he drinks one and I start to drink eight very quickly. The physical allergy kicked in fiercely. If you guys can relate with that, this is absolutely critical. I had no idea that this was part of alcoholism. I didn't know really until I met a sponsor who helped me read the doctor's opinion, you know, when we went through that. And, you know, of course, the whole business of being restless, irritable, and discontent and like the effect, absolutely like the effect. But then that phenomenon of craving, that allergy, holy cow, I have that. And that night I had it and it was fierce. And I basically drank until I couldn't anymore, literally physically couldn't anymore. And I'm screaming at people, yelling at people, puking in this guy's sink. And next thing you know, his parents are right next door and he throws me into the room. And he thinks he's done with me. He's got a drunk guy. He didn't know that. Nobody had much of a history with me. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that I was already practically in the throes of alcoholism. What happened the next morning, the big book talks about the four horsemen, fear, terror, bewilderment, and despair. I wake up and my jeans that were on my body were on the other side of the floor. They were covered in my urine. And I was covered in my urine. But there was something else that was also on the other side of the floor that I did not expect that I would ever do at age 16 or 17. Maybe a 2-year-old or 1-year-old in their diapers would do this. But what I did is in that blackout, I took a poop right next to his bed. I had let my drawers down and I literally out it came and all over me, all over the rug, all over myself, all over the sleeping bag. And I had stepped in it and it was all over the place. And I am literally, you wake up and I'm looking at that. Oh my God. I couldn't believe I did that. Somebody like, what? No. But I was struck sober for about an hour. And then my buddy's asleep and I wake him up and I go, you're not going to believe this. And he looked at me, he was like, oh my God. I mean, there's literally, it's right next to his bed. I mean, I could have done it on him. I mean, I didn't know where I was. I had no idea where I was. And so, what ends up happening is we end up taking, he gets out because his mom, they're still asleep. And we get back in the car. We drive because we got to clean this up. And there was one more beer left. And I took a morning drink again to come up with a game plan. I had no idea. I needed it. I needed a drink to calm my head down, to come up with the idea. And I could barely stuff that thing down. But that was what my mind said. Take a drink. And the mind, what we came up with was that we're going to tell his mom that the cat did it. That this little feline is the animal that absolutely destroyed that house. And you know what? For a second, I believed it because I've got a mind that wants to get out of things. I've got a keen intellectual alcoholic mind. I've got a mind that will believe anything, especially lies. And I had no idea. Boy, I was about to believe a lot more lies when it came to my drinking. And so we told his mom and she was like looking at me as they were pulling the rug and the carpet and the furniture all out from that. And just I'm sitting there in shame. Because also there comes that remorse that, Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion, that remorse of the next day and then that cycle, and I remember saying that this will never happen again. I've got to control it next time. I didn't know that's the mental obsession. I've got to control it next time. And so kids from school, I'm in high school, they come in and they have this one person gave me a roll of toilet paper. Another person said, hey, you're the guy who did this. And I'm like, wow, I'm getting attention because, my heroes were these people who were drunks, sports heroes. I'm a big sports guy and I just loved sports heroes who got in crazy trouble in the press, in the newspaper. But at the same time, I was like, oh my God, I did this and everybody's finding out. There's that self-centered fear. What are they going to think of me? That trap door. And, one of the things that happened out of that was that there's actually been a lot of blessings that have come from that story. At least one blessing and that comes along with working with others. I'm 8 years sober. I'm in Bozeman, Montana. I promise I'm not going to go too much more on the drinking, but I'm 8 years sober and I get a phone call from a guy in Memphis, Tennessee. One of my good buddies had moved from Bozeman to Memphis and he was sponsoring a guy. And this guy I had no idea why he had called me. I didn't know. They didn't have any caller ID. And he goes, are you Pete? I go, yeah. He goes, my buddy Russ just told me that you have some experience taking a poop on somebody's rug. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you help me clean that up? Can you help me make amends for that? And I went, I had no advanced warning of that. That is a higher power. That story became something of use. And I said, this is what I did. I had already made amends for that at that point. So I told him what I did. And he was like, thank you. I'm in tears on that. I mean, I'm not in tears, but I'm like, just that goosebump, kind of the feeling we had this weekend. When we're listening to these speakers sharing these stories, I had that feeling like something as goofy and as shameful as that, or so I thought, now becomes something of absolute use. And it has. I've shared that with lots of people. I share it with sponsees. I share it in meetings. Not because it's a goofy, funny story, but it can be of use. That's one of the things I learned from Al, and I continue to learn. All of this is of use. Nothing goes wasted in God's economy. Absolutely nothing. The good, the bad, the ugly, all my defects of character, everything. And boy, I have them. And I've struggled in sobriety. None of that stuff has gone wasted. None of it. And boy, did I struggle after that experience, though, going back. That was just week one. That was week one. I have that physical, I have that spiritual malady. I've got the physical phenomenon of craving, that allergy that Silkworth talks about and Bill writes about all through those first chapters in the book. And I've got that mental obsession that's already there. I've got to control this. Boy, if anybody has that, wow, good. Now I really see it. And I would say it will never happen again. And it did. Over the next 3 years, I just went through those periods of darkness. I never became an absolute core on daily drinker. I was a binge drinker. I drank for 3 years and 3 months. And there were times in early sobriety, I thought I didn't drink enough. That's a lie. That's an absolute, utter lie. And I said it'll never happen again. It did. It happened once on a train from Chicago to Washington, D.C. I lost control of my bodily functions in a bathroom on Amtrak train. I had those types of experiences. When I got arrested for DUI in Fairfax, Virginia, I had absolutely no idea that I was going to get that drunk that night because I had a girlfriend at that time and I really wanted to control and enjoy my drinking around her because she was on to me. She had heard stories about me. She had heard about the time I went to the emergency room and my dad had to hold me up and to take a pee test because nobody could believe I was that drunk. That was May of 1991. Nobody could believe it. And that's what I put my father through and my mom through. I remember that night and my face was swollen because I had played basketball in a blackout and I landed on my face in the middle of a clear, yes, I was unable to stop the fall. And so that's my dad. That's what he had to go through. That's what that girlfriend had heard those stories. So I really was trying to control my drinking around her. I thought, okay, I want her because, I really want to have a girlfriend because that girlfriend's going to take care of that ache, that anxiousness apartness that I had, that feeling that I don't belong, that I'm not good enough. She's going to make it okay. Boy, I wish I could say I'm done with that pattern. That pattern, boy, that shows up today. I want something. I want somebody to make me okay. Just make me better. So I don't have to, using people. I didn't realize how much of a user I was of people. I didn't know that until I sobered up though. And I really didn't know it at that time. And so the night of that DUI, which ironically, I believe, if this date is correct, and if I remember that date correct, was October the 3rd and the 4th of 1991. And it's on Route 50 outside of Dulles. And I showed up at this party and what I did not expect was that, yep, I really want to control it. And I thought I had done a decent job, not perfect around her. But once I started at that party, I didn't know anybody. I felt inadequate. I didn't feel like I belonged. That fear, that self-centeredness that was just right here, oblivion kicked in. I drank to the absolute form of blackout, and I'm driving behind the wheel of that car. She tries to get the keys for me. I wouldn't let her. And before you know it, I'm in and out of a blackout, Werving and swerving on Route 50 right outside of Dulles, trying to get home. And the way I look at it now is the police saved my life. I got arrested for a DUI and it had been and fake identification. It was the fifth arrest. And that saved my life. I am so grateful. I'm grateful that they were doing their job. And that my ex-girlfriend at that time, who has not yet wanted to receive amends from me, I'm willing, but at that time he saved her life too, because I don't believe we were going to make it. I wasn't going to make it. I was out. I was gone. And I felt a sense of surrender when I was in that cop car. I don't know if anybody can relate with that. You're in the police or you've got that weird feeling that the gig is up and that this game is over. And in this mental anguish that I had been in, I was in college and I thought I was going to be this great sports writer. And things were just slipping away. I was just, I wanted to be somebody. I thought I would, and it was just starting to slip away. My grades were falling apart. I couldn't show up. I had this sense of impending doom that was just with me. And a drink wasn't turning that away. It did a little bit. And even after that DUI, when my then girlfriend picked me up and she looked at me in horror when she took me home. And the first thing I did was I grabbed a drink of alcohol and she looked at me like, what are you doing? And I looked at her like, I need this. That absolute obsession went on for another month and a half. My parents get on the phone. They found out about that DUI. They call me up. They're in Virginia. I'm in Pennsylvania. And before you know it, there was something that happened because at that point, you know, Bill Wilson talks about cursing himself for a weakling. That's all I was doing. I was doing that on a daily basis, cursing myself for an absolute weakling. I thought this drink, which was the incredible solution in my life, had bitten me and had become a frenemy. I loved it and hated it at the same time. I didn't know how to get rid of it. I didn't know how to stop it because somebody like me, sober, needs a drink after a while. I don't do well sober. I'm that, all that fear, all that restlessness, that irritability and that discontentedness, that sense of agitation, that self-centeredness is who I am. That's who I am today. I'm not cured of that. I need to be in the middle of AA to have a shot at dealing with that. Boy, at that time, though, it was just, my head was just loud and just screaming, and I felt shame and guilt. And that last night of, you know, I had no idea when they made that call, when my mom and dad found out about it from a lawyer's letter, that the night before that, I had actually turned down to go to a party. Somebody said, Pete, would you like to drink? And I couldn't because that I had an overwhelming sense of doom that the next time I drink alcohol, I was going to kill somebody. I was going to get behind the wheel of a car and I was going to kill somebody. And I think that was the next thing. That's what happened. I drank and drove a lot. When I got caught, that was only once. I had done it many other times. And so when my mom was on the phone, there's something she didn't harangue me. There's something about my mom's voice when she was just sad and concerned. Nobody said stop. She just said, I'm concerned. We're concerned. And I heard her. There was something that went through that went through the head. And there was a surrender where I said, I'm done. And I meant it. I meant business. You know, I'm done. And I remember feeling that sense of relief that there was a burden, that monkey that was on my back was lifted. But what I didn't realize was that I was dealing with something way greater than even that. And that was called alcoholism. All the stuff that I've been sharing with you about all that fear, the self-centeredness, the restless irritability and discontentedness. It took me about 3 months before I came into my first meeting on February 1st, 1992. That was from a nudge from the judge, even though I thought I was having a heart attack, and I went to that meeting in State College. And a lot of times when I share, I overlook that part of my story, maybe because it wasn't when I ran into that great structure of Alcoholics Anonymous when I moved to Bozeman, Montana, when I ran into that wall that knew the big book and that knew, you know, how to be of service to others and be in a home group that is active and enthusiastic and you want to be with each other and you meet a lot and you meet frequently and you help others and you go on 12-step calls. I overlook at that because I had one foot in AA, one foot out. Those people were beautiful people. They had a message. As I shared at the beginning, they helped me to the best of their ability where I, you know, ended up making amends to my grandfather with a year and a half sober. Even though I had, in that first year and a half, I was doing lots of therapy and lots of self-analysis. And this is just my experience. It didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because for me, what it did is it made me more separate from my family. I was focusing on analyzing myself. I was focused. And then, of course, when I did that, my keen intellectual resentful mind will then start to pin this on somebody else. I've got to watch that vigilantly today. I've got a mind that will pin anything on somebody else for me to absolutely avoid the accountability and the responsibility of looking at me. And boy, And so that was what my state was at that time. That's why I overlook it. Not because, oh yeah, they didn't have good AA. I was like that and blaming others constantly. I'm exceedingly grateful for that experience with my grandfather because it has given me a mission. Not to become the best family member, not to become a people pleaser, because family also, if I get wrapped up in it, I can become insane with it. It's not my higher power. But looked at through the steps, boy, there are actions that I can take where I literally can carry out what my grandfather told me that day, you know, which is that I do have a family and that it's a good thing to be a part of it. And you know what? Today, I want that. I want to be a part of it. I want to be a family member among family members. I want to be somebody that can share emotion and cry like I did with, and hopefully not just when people are dying, you know, just to let emotions out and that it's okay. My dad said that to me a couple of days ago. He said, it's okay. Letting my dad be my dad, letting my mom be my mom. I spent a lot of time in sobriety not doing that. I ran from that, and I'll get to that in a second. Because when I moved to Bozeman, I did run into that ethic. And I ran into people that knew how to read the big book to me. They read it to me, and that's how I sponsor guys. I take people through, and they were big book. Al likes to call them big book fanatics, and they really were. And I love that. I needed it. I absolutely need it. You know, because one of the things when you go through it and then you start sponsoring it is the big book comes alive. It becomes an absolute useful tool, not as some kind of knowledge thing, you know, as a hey, look at me, I got this. I know that big book. I'm special, but it becomes something of absolute use where I can be of maximum service. I can be of help to some other alcoholic. And so I went through the steps on a more rigorous basis because I realized that that time and place was going to come where I was going to drink again. Because when I moved to Bozeman, I had come through Yellowstone Park. And I thought that I was going to, you know, I still was looking for that solution from the outside that was going to make it okay, a geographic. And it turned out to be the best geographic I could have possibly taken because it brought me into an enthusiastic group that gave me roots in AA. It gave me a home. And I did an inventory that was as rigorous as I could possibly do. And I really started to see that on the backside of those resentments in that fourth column, which is absolutely critical. It's critical for me to see that part because that's what shows me the defects of character. And that's what also shows me what I need to make right in the amends. The fourth column. And I was not doing that in those first 2 years. I was really hesitant to look at that fourth column. Boy, was I hesitant. I was very happy to look at columns 1 and 2. And even column 3, I didn't understand what self-esteem meant. It's actually been years in sobriety where I've gone through the steps where I realized those instincts are threatened. And when those instincts are threatened, I act out. I act out. When I'm scared, I act out. When my ambition is threatened, I act out. When my security is threatened, I act out. And, you know, Lord knows, who knows what I'll do. A lot of times for me is I'll use people and I'll run and I'll slink away without telling people the truth. I had no idea how dishonest I was. And so that experience then led me into amends, and I had amends to make for all the vandalism I did. And I made amends to my mom and dad to the best that I could at the time. I realize now that there's more that I needed to do. And I made amends. There was a long list, and I went through and I checked them off and had some incredible experiences. One lady at Penn State, she said her boss told her not to see me because I was one of those rambunctious college students that swore and did vandalism all over her floor. And she hated me, but she somehow said, God told me that it was okay for me to let you in my office that day when I went. It was 1996. I'll never forget that trip because on my way, I was listening to speaker tapes. I was listening to Chuck C's, A New Pair of Glasses. And I'm just listening to that all the way. And I go in there and she tells me what I can do to make it right. She goes, find a fraternity, pay for the vandalism, and this is what you can do to clear it up with me, is that you can now help others make amends. You have made it right with me. You can help others. And so it started to put me on a path. When I made amends, I started to have that connection, that great reality that's deep down within. And I started to meet people like Tim Kaye, who's one of my first ever sponsees. And I was 25 and, you know, a couple of years sober. poor guy had to listen to me talk, and I'm babbling, taking him through the book, you know, and the blind leading the blind. And it's what a beautiful thing to see him almost 25 years sober today in the Howe Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, this makes me emotional. He's helping others to see that ripple of what happened when he came in, and to start helping others and to see them start to help others is something that that's the biggest joy. I sometimes forget that. I sometimes think that the primary purpose needs to be my career, or it needs to be something else. It needs to be getting a girlfriend. It needs to be something that's going to make me okay on the outside. But what I realize now, and especially during this pandemic in these last 6-7 months, that my real primary purpose is to be a maximum service to alcoholics. And it is to absolutely carry the message. It's to be transparent. It's to not to look good in here. It's to absolutely share what's going on. Currently, whatever past experiences can be of use, but just to be open and honest and be an open book and help people for fun and for free, even when it's inconvenience. Larry T was talking about that. I love that. And Al used to share that with me. I didn't quite understand it when I moved to Charlottesville. What does it mean to be divinely inconvenienced and all that stuff? And then I started to see examples of that. And the examples of that are that here's the real truth. People who are doing things that are divinely inconvenient have what I want. There's no other way around it. When I see people doing that and giving up of their time, giving up what they think is, you know, they're putting aside, they're doing God's work. They're taking care of God's kids. And that's for fun and for free. And when I do that, I get everything I need. But like I said, I have had times where I have forgotten that. And my primary purpose became getting something else. I thought I needed to become some super meditator, and I ended up meditating myself off to India. And I thought that I needed to become that. And I didn't realize at that point, I see it now looking back, that I was using that as a weapon. I was also using it as an escape. And I completely missed the point of the 11th step. There's so much in that 11th step, what we do in the morning, what we do at night, and of course, other steps like the 10th step. That part of the nightly review is really, how did I do my 10th step today? And I had missed the morning part and all the part that in the middle of the day. I recently went to a meeting where I heard that that's like 96% or 7 or 8% of the 11th step. And I had missed all of it, thinking that I was focused on the stuff that is going to make me try to look good and sound spiritual. That's the kind of sick mind I've got. I'll use anything. I'll even use AA. Oh, yeah, look at me. I made all these amends. I'm cool. Trying to look good in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's kind of pathetic, actually. But when I get down and do that, well, the problem is me, not you. The problem is me. But hey, one of the cool things about that experience is that is now in my arsenal to help others. And it has. It is something that has, believe it or not, maybe somebody hasn't said I need to go to India, but hey, I started to study Tibet. I started to do this work that I've been working in China. And one of the things that happened as I went through this recent inventory, I had no idea that inch by inch, step by step, I actually was taking actions that were taking me out of Alcoholics Anonymous over the last 5 to 6 years. And I had no idea, nobody else's fault. I wasn't being rigorously honest anymore. I was covering things up. I was lying to the IRS. I started getting a rush out of going on tax. My favorite day of the year was the day I would go into the H&R Block and basically cheat on my taxes, because I thought, oh my God, I'm going to save some money. I had no idea that that's what I was doing, and it was lying and stealing, but I thought I was winning. I'm getting them. You know what? Maybe somebody else can get away with that. One of my colleagues here did. She said, hey, that's what I do. And my mind says, hey, that sounds good to me. I had my moral compass. I wasn't in the middle of AA, and I had great sponsorship, but there was something that was disconnected. I was not as connected as the relationship with God was. I wasn't asking God for help. I was using self-reliance. And so when I started this work in China, which in many cases has been an incredible experience to be in another culture and to try to help out in Alcoholics Anonymous over there, it's a fledgling. You want to talk about the frontier of AA. Oh my God. Sponsoring people over there was tough. I mean, just even, unbelievably tough, let alone language barriers, but just a lot of even expats like me and people ran. They ended up running there. You know what? So was I. I was, even though I thought I was having this, you know, this PhD experience over there, I was running and I was disconnected. I felt alienated from the fellowship. Nobody did that to me. I was taking step by step, inch by inch. I had lost my enthusiasm. It was becoming gray. I was living on past experiences. I was living on what I had done, but I also knew that in my heart that I knew that I was doing wrong. And I couldn't, and I wasn't telling anybody about it. I've heard hear stories of people leave AA, and I know I got to wrap this up, but I tell you what, I ended up having an affair with a married woman over there. And that's not what I wanted to do, but I did it. And she wasn't at fault. I did it. I got involved in it because I thought I needed that relief. I needed the relief from my head. And when I went through this inventory a couple of months ago, I ended up switching. I had a sponsor switch here to a guy that I worked through the steps with in Bozeman. And he said, Pete, I cannot believe you have stayed sober with the level of dishonesty and selfishness that you have been living in. And I looked at him and I said, I can't either. And I tell you what, the guy who was, I had no idea I needed to even do that step work. This is at the pretty much the beginning of the pandemic, a couple of months into the pandemic. I had no idea that I was living and taking those selfish actions. And now, you know, having done that fifth step, a thorough fifth step, where I cried, went through it. Not crying isn't the goal of the fifth step, but I saw the truth. That's why. And then steps 6 and 7 became something that I actually embraced, not ran away from or jumped over. I started to see the defects that were really, really causing havoc in my and others' lives. And then now I'm making amends. You know, I had a birthday. I'll stop because it is time, but I had a birthday, not an AA birthday, but a couple of months ago. And it was time for my parents wanted to give me a gift. See, 2 years ago, I sat in their kitchen and this is what happens when you're crusty and dry. I basically shared and blamed them all for all my problems. I was 27 years sober. And I sat in their kitchen and said, you don't love me enough. You don't give me enough attention. You don't do these things for me. That might have been the absolute, looking back on it, one of the worst days of my sobriety. It was a terrible performance. And I wish I could put those words back. I wish I had never said them. But one of the things that's happening now, and that will be a 9-step amends in person, perhaps even this week, is that actions have started to change. I don't criticize them anymore. You know what's been beautiful is that when I've stopped criticizing my parents, and I didn't realize how much I did it, they've stopped criticizing me. When I let my mom be my mom, she's a beautiful person. When I let my dad be my dad, I'm like, okay, I can't fix, manage, and control it. And so my heart is full. I've got grief. I'm going to be making a trip back to New Jersey this week. And you know what's going to, I'm going to be in the middle of? I'm going to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You, the middle of God, taking care of God's kids. We'll get through that. Not for fun and for free. And to be a source of love and comfort. Not what I can get out of the deal. What can I bring? And I'm sorry I went over a couple of minutes. It is an absolute honor and a pleasure to have been here tonight. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you, Billy.